Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Anyway, I'm going to read to you. Thou Trinity, beyond being, direct us to the heights of mystical revelation, sublime beyond all thought and light, wherein the simple, absolute, and immutable mysteries of divine truth are hidden in the translucent darkness of that silence which revealeth in secret. For this darkness, though of deepest obscurity, is yet radiantly clear, and though beyond touch and sight, it overfills our unseeing minds with splendors of transcendent beauty. This is my prayer. As for you, beloved Timothy, exerting yourself sincerely in mystical contemplation, quit the senses, the workings of the intellect, and all that may be sensed and known, and all that is not and that is. For by this you may unknowingly attain, insofar as it is possible, to the oneness of Him who is beyond all being and knowledge. Thus, through indomitable, absolute, and pure detachment of yourself from all things, you will be lifted up to that radiance of the divine darkness which is beyond being, surpassing all and free from all. Free from all. That's the beginning of the Theologia Mystica, or the Mystica Theologia. You know, from the moment we're born, we may not be conscious as such. You know, we're conscious, but we don't know how to think. So, but in watching the baby, you know, she was, let's see, was it last? No, it was Friday night. And they were trying very hard to give her some water, because she was getting a little jaundiced because she wouldn't eat and she wouldn't drink any water. So here's David, big David, you know, little bundle, and trying to get her to, you know, with his bottle, you know, trying to get her. And she, I'm not going to have any water. And she almost said it, you know, and stubborn as all get out already. And she can't even think. She can be handful. Yeah. But... You know, because we arrive in this world with some difficulty, some more, some less, and we come from this place where it's dark and it's comfortable, it's warm, we're fed, we don't have to do a thing. We never have to learn to think. We don't have to do anything, just be there. And now, okay, we're out in this world and it's suddenly it's not dark anymore, it's light out there. And they pick us up. You know, it's the first thing that happens. We get picked up, and already we have fear. We're going to be dropped. They don't even know. They can't think that they're up in the air and off the ground, but it's there immediately. So we all get a little bit skitzed right away. A little bit. Skosh. A little bit skitzed. See? And then on top of that, you see, as we go along, we've got two eyes and two ears and two nostrils and two hands. And we, you know, we come to believe in two. And some people have diplopia, you know, their eyes get a little funny every now and then and they see two. They're looking at a person across the street, and all of a sudden it's two persons. So, it's just like the little story of the man who was entertaining his friend, and he hadn't seen him in a long, long time. And he had a son who saw double. And so he sent the son down, though. He said, there's a bottle of wine in the basement, in the wine cellar. And it's very, very special, and I've been saving it for just this occasion because I haven't seen him for so long. And he says, the son goes down to get the wine, and he comes back up, and he says, but Father, there are two bottles of wine. What'll I do with the other one? Break it. And then there were none. It happens to people. The thing is that what we know is sort of based on this, and we believe in this two-ness. We're caught in it, and we cling to this two-ness. It's our duality, we call it, not two-ness. Yeah. Anyway, and then because of our education, and the religious education is included in this, and our what we know of science, we believe in two worlds. We have a world of matter and a world of spirit. And we hope that this world of spirit is where we're going to reside someday. We keep this out there as a golden ring. And we keep these two worlds as far apart as possible. The spirit aspect is certainly never to know what this matter aspect is all about. It wouldn't understand, or it wouldn't understand me, what I'm doing with it. Keep them apart. What's going on here is secret, and what's going on over there is secret from me, but I'm going to find it out someday, but I will leave all this secret behind, if you understand what I mean. We have then outer matter, and we have inner spirit, and we have body and soul. We have a lower and a higher world. And we have the separation then, because of this lower and higher. So we have a separation between sin and virtue. We don't think that they're dependent on each other, which they are. We think of them as separate. Over here is sin and over here is virtue. But you can't have this without this, and you can't have this without this. We think too. There's a separation between a sinner and a saint. He does this, he's no good. He does this, he's fine. And therefore we plow through the whole thing all the time wanting our own way, which we don't even understand. We're divided, and we're so fragmented that it's almost a miracle that we manage to keep ourselves together. What we need to do is to get beyond this division. We need to reach the one, sometimes called unity, one, which is neither this nor that, neither man nor woman. And that one, or that unity, has been called by the mystics various names. It's been called God, it's been called truth, it's been called Moksha, it's been called Nirvana, it's been called the Absolute, the Dharma, the Tao, it's the one with 99 names. Now, having taken apart the word God last week, I did, didn't I? Yeah. Maybe now we can use it without an image. Can you? If someone says the word God, what pops in your mind? We have this little box and things pop out of it in here. somebody says God, what happened in there? What popped up? Watch your mind. Don't look at me. You're looking at something in there. You know, your mind is supposed to be somewhat trained. After all, you have sat for a little while, sitting for meditation. So you're supposed to be somewhat trained in watching your mind. And then, you know, being trained to watch it, you can also be somewhat in control of it. There is that which we in the Western world call God. But that word, God, is not God. And the picture or the image that you carry in your head is not God. So God is, well, we don't know what. No. Until you know God is an unknown. And we don't have to pretend over that. I don't know. If you pretend, you're not ever going to get close. Pretending's no good. So let's drop all these pretenses and look, to simply look into ourselves with eyes that are clear of images and a mind that is free of concepts. You just look. Someday you will be very much amazed with this looking, this observation. You know, it's I hammer at it and hammer at it and hammer at it. And I don't know what happens as soon as you walk out that door. You forget all about it. If you want to find God, or whatever you call it, train your mind to observe. To look. Because your mind looks. And then there's something in the mind, the eye of mind, that can look in another direction. Now, Dionysius is thought to be the originator of this Mystica Theologia, the mystical theology. Mystical theology. Theologia Mystica. And there have been mystics east and west. East, we had the Bodhidharma, Lin Chi or Rinzai, Yong Chia, Hakuin, Weinen, and so on and so on and so on. Lao Tzu, there are lots of them. In the west, we find like Jacob Burma, Meister Eckhart, St. Francis, St. John of the Cross, and his teacher, Mother Teresa of Avila. And I think we could include in that maybe St. Paul. St. John? Okay. Now, there is mention of a Dionysius in the New Testament. He was a bishop in Athens in the first century. He was converted to Christianity by St. Paul. So St. Paul, in a way, was, we could say, was his teacher. Now, in that first century, Christianity wasn't very well established. The first 20 years, you know, the Christians spent underground. They lived in the catacombs there in Rome. And it's amazing. There's still some skeletons there. Anyway, it was a very dangerous and perilous time if you believed in what Jesus said and that he was resurrected after he was crucified. It was, you know, Christianity was one little sect amongst all these other religions running around there. The main competition and the strongest religion at that time was the religion of Zoroaster. And this little band of Christians went to the Emperor Constance and made a deal with him. If he would become a Christian, they would gather up all their menfolk and they would go to battle in this particular battle that he was losing that he wanted very much to win. So all the Christians rounded up their friends and they went to battle for Emperor Constance and they won for him. And so the Christian church became legal. Dionysius became the Bishop of Athens. Here now we have a mystic within the church. And these writings of his, and he has written several books. Some of them are very difficult to understand. This one I like. They were not published until the 6th century. And at that time, at the 6th century, there was another man by the name of Dionysius. And he was a Gnostic. He was a mystic. And some people think that he wrote this and not this Dionysius back there in Athens in the first century, but this is the sixth century Dionysius. And I think many more people believe it was the latter Dionysius that wrote this rather than the first one, or the latter, because there were lots of them in between. It was a very popular name. It was the name of one of the gods. So there's a lot of them. But anyway, by the 6th century, which was, a couple of centuries after the Council of Nicaea, and it was the Council of Nicaea that decided the fate of the direction of the church. They had something like 50 years of argument, and there were something like 350 bishops and cardinals and priests there arguing. Should they accept a form of mysticism, that is the Gnostics of that day, should they accept that in the church? What do we do about the doctrines of the church? Should we go the way of dogma rather than go the way of the mystic? And they decided the dogma way would be the way to go. This then would be their doctrine. Because, yes, this we can understand. See, we will have the creeds, and we will have the rules, and we will have the regulations, and all this Gnostic stuff, we just don't understand it. So what are we going to do with it? Except at the same time, they had to have it because they didn't have any structure as such. So they used both Plato and Aristotle for structure. And all the Gnostics became heretics. They were the mystics, and that word was a bad word. Interesting, hmm? We should be sitting here as Zoroastrians. Except for this deal that they made. You see, everything we know about ourselves is by chance. Now, when you're thinking about religion, remember there's two ways to respond to it, to religion as such. We can say respond, let us say, to Christianity as a religion about Jesus. And this primarily is what people do, because people will call me on the telephone and ask me, what is this Zen that we've got, and I'll say, blah, 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 blah. And they'll say, well, if this is Christian Zen or Western Zen, and it's Zen, which is usually Buddhism, but, it doesn't have to be Buddhism. It doesn't. It because it's a backdrop there now of Buddhism doesn't mean, this. But so we can have Christian Zen, and there is Christian Zen in Japan. There's Father Dumoulin, Loyola Dumoulin, and he is from Switzerland. And then there's another one from Scotland, and then there is Father LaSalle. Now, Father LaSalle and Father Dumoulin, when they come to, Europe, their people come together, you know, in these cities, 2,000 at a time. Tremendous. And both of them are, those two are Catholics. Father Johnson is an Episcopalian. But they all three have zendos, where people come to sit. And they teach a Christian Zen. There is this monk in Frankfurt. He's spent time in Japan, and they made him a Roshi over there. And the community of monks in Frankfurt built him a Zendo so he could train the other priests and the nuns and the lay people. And they're all doing meditation. Christian Zen. It's Zen. I mean, they're after the same thing. You know, that thing which you're supposed to keep in mind. Anyway, we can respond to religion as if it were a religion about Jesus, because that's pretty much what it is. It's about him. And people will say to me, oh, that's where my point anyway. What do you do about Jesus? If you're going to do Christian Zen, what do you do with Jesus? After all, he's a whole central figure of Christianity. And I say, well, he fits in very nicely. Why not? Huh? He does. Now, about Christianity is about Jesus. Because of this Nicene Council. And it sort of misses something. Except maybe in some of the monasteries and in some of the upper echelon of the cardinals who know pretty much what's going on. But Jacob Needleman wrote a book called Lost Christianity, and in it he explains what we have lost in Christianity, and it's a very good book to read. Anyway, this religion, this stream, river of religion, It moves from its source. There is the source, and then it moves out. And the more it moves out, the more we find morals given, ethics given. And we find less and less talk of the mystical. Less and less talk that you can know, that it's not just about. It's of. You should know. Now, Buddhism, in a way, has this problem also, but they have less of it. I mean, their teachers are pretty well trained. One can study Buddhism as a religion about Buddha. Or you can look at it from a point of view that you are Buddha nature, and you're going to wake up one day and be a Buddha. The only thing is you have to work. So you can prove this, that you are the Buddha nature. And looking at Buddhism and the East, we find that there are many, many who have done just that. And looking at Christianity, we find a few. And the few that did are called heretics. You know, like Meister Eckhart was excommunicated. It's too bad, huh? These mystics. But, you know, Jesus, when he spoke to his disciples, he spoke differently than he did to the multitudes. He gave them more because, you see, they were closer to him, so they were closer to this source. And the multitudes, you know, maybe hearing him once or twice, and not understanding, or at least certainly understanding less, because of lack of training. I think we don't realize, after we've been in something like this for, say, 10 years, how you have been conditioned to always look and to keep this one thing in mind, you know, that when you begin to talk to other people about religion, you're kind of wondering what they're talking about. Anyway, so this Dionysius, he gave to his disciples more than he gave to his parishioners, generally. So this is a letter to one of his disciples, Timothy. My dear Timothy. And Timothy was, he's a disciple, so he has had some discipline. He's disciplined to observe. And he's disciplined, you know, so that some mind training is in there. You know, some understanding is with him. And he trusts. A disciple like Timothy trusts. You know, he trusts beyond any arguing with his teacher, with the master, You know, that mysteries, these profound mysteries in the, of the depths, you know, they cannot be argued about. You can't go into a book and look up truth. It's an impossibility. And then turn around and try to argue right and wrong. You see, this is the two-ness right away again. There are no proofs for truth. Except, finally, what you see and have validated. So then you find it in your heart, and you find your trust. And you should trust your teacher at least this much, to allow him or her to hold your hand, to allow him to take you to the window and say, look. If you argue about the window, and if you argue about the scene, the sky and the flowers and the trees and all existence, there is no way. And there is no one that can help you. There is no one that you will believe then that can say there is a truth to be discovered. There is a truth to be discovered. That we live in a mystery of mysteries. And that that mystery can be experienced. You know, that your heart, you know, can open when you see this, and it can pour out in this love of this mystery. And not only that, but it answers and it fills your heart again. There are no proofs of God. You can maybe convince yourself and, you know, so on and so on, but actually, there are no proofs of God running around here. I mean, you can't look it up in a book, and it doesn't come in a tape, and, you know, somebody else can't tell you that. You can convince yourself there is God, or you can unconvince yourself. You know? And it's certainly not a question of convincing somebody else, because this is not a conversion to a certain ideology. It is simply an overpowering love affair. Now, if you come across a person such as this Dionysius, the very presence of the man is enough. It's kind of a proof that there are many more things in life that we have ever dreamed of. You know, religion is supposed to enhance your life. It enriches not only your life, but your being. It creates many possibilities for you. And it gives a kind of an elan, you know, an elation. Elan vital, as Bergson put it. After all, you know, Jesus did say, rejoice, rejoice. I say to you, rejoice. You're living. You're adventuring. You're experimenting. You're looking for this unknown with great vitality. Great spirit. You are looking. And of course, you're looking with hope. We're not supposed to feel guilty and glum and frustrated in religion. And we're not supposed to be long-faced with righteousness. That's nothing but rigidity. A religious experience, you know, a mystical experience, is an insightful event. It is an insight, an event of insight, by which something can be felt, can be known, but usually we can't describe it. There comes about a kind of a speechlessness. We don't have words much in the English language for the experiences. Sanskrit is a technical language which was developed for explanation. But you see, so many of these words can't be translated. I mean, if I say dharma, well, right away, oh yeah, we know what that means. That's the law, that's the duty, and maybe not. Maybe it's something more than that. But there's something more that cannot be translated. When you have the experience of seeing the Dharma, and then you'll know what Dharma is. So without these words and being in the state, there is a kind of an innocence. There's a kind of a naivete. You know, there's a guilelessness. A kind of an ignorance. You know, we look outside and there's the products of Mother Nature. Well, together with God, of course, but look at her. All the wonders that she has produced, including yourself, that you can open your mouth and that you can open your eyes and see and that you can hear and you can pick up your feet and walk and you can use your hands to pick up things. These are miracles. Mother Nature, in all the wonders that she has produced, all without words. She works in a kind of an unconsciousness. And that unconsciousness is not used as the psychotherapists use. Psychotherapist unconscious is a kind of a coma or something out of which unconscious in a religious sense is different. It is an innocent ignorance. And I don't know how one can explain this ignorance or this innocence. I don't know how to explain that. All you have to do is to become it and you will know it. I cannot tell you what it's like. But in that innocence and in that ignorance, we live and move and have our being. Dionysius, though, he had a word for this ignorant innocence. He called it agnosia. Gnosis. You know, it's a Greek for knowing. And so from this we have the atheist who says there is no God. Yeah. And when he says there is no God, he says it as if he knows that there is no God. There's no question mark in it at all. He knows there is no God. This is the way he talks, as if he knows. As if he had explored the whole universe and, you know, no reality, you know, other than, he has come to know that there is no God. No. This is the declaration of his knowledge. So we could say his knowledge is his knowing. This is the declaration of his knowing, his gnosis. Yeah. Atheist. A theist, from the word theos, which is God, and a is a negation thereof, just like in Sanskrit. Yeah. Then the theist says, there is a God. There is God. And he says it as if he knows. Yeah. As if he has just met him. As if he has attained. As if he had arrived to this ultimate. And God was there and, you know, shook his hand. Yeah. That's his gnosis. That's his knowledge. Theism is the belief that God is immanent, that is within all this, and also transcends all this. That's theism. Deism is that God is transcendent and has nothing to do with the creatures here, with his figment of imagination. Not concerned with his creatures at all. He's out there. And then, of course, pantheism is that all is God. And the church frowns upon pantheism. God is immanent and God is transcendent. So agnosia, agnostic. Bertrand Russell said he was an agnostic. Yeah, is a skeptical one, agnosia. I don't know. Just, I don't know. It's not this way and it's not that way. I'm ignorant. Now, to keep this ignorance, I don't know. To keep this ignorance and this not knowing, while you are looking, you're not saying, well, I don't know and I'm not supposed to know. You know, this has been, some people have said that to me, what are you, you're not supposed to know God. It's terrible what you're doing. A lot of kind of people out there. You know, and they say, there is no way to know. You know, one is not supposed to shut the door. At least if you're not going to do anything about it, at least keep the door open. And keep him in mind. Dionysius says that one can know God when one comes to the moment, that moment, where you know nothing. It's a state of not knowing. And that opens the door. The not knowing. And here we sit with our cotton picking all these things that we know. Ho, ho, ho. Yongjia, or as we call him, EQ. He said, you cannot grasp it. You cannot get rid of it. And not being able to get it, you get it. When you are silent, it speaks. And when you speak, it is silent. See, this is our confusion. This is our dilemma. We expect it to answer us just like we're talking to him. Yeah. Now, agnosia, this not knowing, this open door, you know, meditation allows you to enter that state. Agnosia allows you, if you're doing it properly, to unburden this mountainous load of conditioning. It helps you to unlearn. Most of us have learned certain ways of looking at things. You know, we had religion in Sunday school, and we had, or the church or the temple, and young enough so that, you know, there's something was burned into the psyche, so to speak, about religion. Now, how to deal with this? You know, this is this child still believing in whatever you were taught. Huh? What was I taught? Oh, I remember. See? I can remember walking in the snow with my father. on Christmas Eve. You've heard this all before. We'd been to church. It was Christmas Eve, and it was for the children. They had a big tree, so my father took me. And we're walking home in the snow, and I have this nice bag of, he's got one hand, and I got a bag of candy in the other, you know. And he said, "Did you enjoy that?" And I thought, "Well, yeah, I think I enjoyed that. Yes, I enjoyed it." And he says, "And you like the candy?" "Yeah, I like the candy." "Enjoy it. It's the only thing you're going to get out of going to church." It set the pattern for me, I guess. I don't know. Henry's looked at me and he says, "But I told him about it." He says, "A little young, don't you think? We got to have something in there. A little young." But anyway, we learn about religion in Sunday school when we're little. And, you know, some words come up, it pops up in the mind. And, and we see this image. How to deal with it? How to deal with this child that lives in us? People get angry, and they don't realize there's this little kid sitting in here having a tantrum. Yeah. Well, so you sit. Maybe you have some therapy. You get rid of it. You know how to deal with this kid. Or at least you read some good books on how to deal with this kid. It's in here. 4 years old, 5 years old. And for all the rest of it, you can sit and ignore it and it will straighten itself out, because these are all these little fragments, these little jigs in the jigsaw puzzle that are never, ever going to come together. Never. You know, and there's something else I think we should say to this little kid inside. We may have learned this when we were 5, but that doesn't mean it's true. And this is something we never say to this kid. It may not be true. Let's find out. And you shut up until I do. Yeah. So you sit for meditation, and it places you. Meditation. Now, the sitting for is a practice, of course. But the meditation itself, it places you in a vast silence. You're no longer clinging to any belief. And you're no longer in any doubt. There's no room for any of that. It's just this vast silence. And this is what Dionysius called agnosia. It is through this I don't know. This agnosia comes to know. A very strange state of affairs, I think. This ultimate paradox. By not knowing, one comes to know, and by knowing, one misses. Yeah. It's a very strange moment, you know, and one arrives at this, and it's described by this Dionysius with this tremendous beauty. He calls it the translucent darkness. The darkness which is pure light. There's a book, and I think the name of it is The Gathering of the Birds, or The Conference of the Birds, or The Garden of the Birds, or something like that. It's a Sufi book. It's about birds. And there is one particular bird, and he's very smart, and he is a lapwing bird, whatever that is. I was going to look it up before I came, but I didn't have time. Anyway, but all the birds come to this conference, this convention, you know, and they gather around this lapwing, and they ask him about the road that leads to the hidden palace. And so he describes the journey for them and the valleys that one must go through. And the first valley is the Valley of the Quest. one searches. One must strive before anything can be known. One must strive before anything can happen. One must put forth some effort. We may be unique, each and every one of us, but there is not a one of us that is so special that heaven should drop into our lap just because we want it. Now, this is not even 2 years old, it's less. So, and it is in this valley of the quest, and some people are in it a long, long time, the valley of the quest, where the traveler, the seeker, the searcher, must strip himself of earthly things and become poor in spirit. Right? We keep harping on this. What is this poor in spirit? What is this poverty? What is this poverty? The poor in spirit. Dante's Purgatorio describes this, that part of his poem. The purification and the self-stripping, which no mystic system is without. Then when we've gone through that, there is, about the end of it, here comes this ray of light, and it touches you, and it brings you out of the valley of the quest into the valley of love. And this is Dante's earthly paradise, the beginning of illumination. Then we come from that, we go through that, you know, we're on this. The Bible calls it the glassy sea. You know, we come to the valley of knowing, or the valley of enlightenment, and we're here now as the mystery of being is revealed, and then God is seen in all things. You know, it is He that has gone abroad. All this is for the habitation by the Lord. Then you begin to see what is going on. You have this sight. Then we go through the valley of detachment, they call it, in which one is utterly absorbed in the divine. And this then leads to the valley of unity. See, and here now, this the Godhead, beyond God, the Godhead is the focus of meditation. You keep this in mind, huh? The focus of meditation. And this leads to the valley of amazement. See, where this vision seems to be taken away altogether. And he is plunged into this darkness and this tremendous bewilderment. And this is the state which Dionysius and the medieval mystics call the divine dark, the cloud of unknowing. It is dark from its excessive brightness. It is so bright you cannot see, so it's dark. Yeah. And the last valley, of course, is the annihilation of the self. Okay, many Sufi system. Many systems, many descriptions, and if they're valid, they're all pointing to that one thing that must be kept in mind. Your focus. Your observing. Now, this Bishop of Athens, he writes, and we're assuming now that he wrote this instead of this Dionysius that lived in the 6th century, okay? And he uses, of course, Christian terminology. It was come to the place where it was a little difficult to do anything else. And he starts out, "Thou Trinity beyond being, direct us to the height of mystical revelation, sublime beyond all thought and light, wherein the simple, absolute, and immutable mysteries of divine truth are hidden in the translucent darkness of that silence which silence revealeth in secret." "For this darkness, though of deepest obscurity, is yet radiantly clear." Excuse me. "And though beyond touch and sight, it overfills our unseeing minds with splendors of transcendent beauty." reading, and whoever translated it did a marvelous job. Now, in Buddhism, there is a trinity also. It's called the Tripitaka, or the three baskets. Also, we have the three bodies of Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the Nirmanakaya, and the Sambhogyakaya. The body of the Dharma, the body of the Nirmanakaya, which is the becoming body, and the Sambhogyakaya, which is the body of bliss. Dharma is the body of law, or truth. Now, in Hinduism, we find Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. We may not have the rest of this. And they are called the three faces of God. Also, they are called Atma, Buddhi, Manas. The self and the knowing and the mind. Atma, Buddhi, Manas. In Christianity, we also find this trinity, and they are thought of as three persons, the three persons of God. So we have God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. Three persons in one. And they are thought of as persons, as beings. Now this is the trinity of God. Now comes this man, and he says, "Thou Trinity, beyond being, direct us to the height of mystical revelation." The Upanishads begin very similar to this. Each section, the Kina, the Katha, and Isha Upanishad, and all the rest of them, they start out with something like this: direct us, lead us, guide us from darkness to light. We are in darkness, O Lord. Lead us, guide us, direct us, so that we can move into the world of light. Guide us, lead us, direct us from the world of untruth to the world of truth. We are living in death. We are surrounded by death. O Lord, lead us from death to deathlessness, from time to timelessness, lead us to eternal immortality. They all begin with something like that, which is, you know, their supplication, their prayer. And generally, we have a notion that prayer must be directed to someone, namely to God or to Jesus or St. Jude or Christopher or St. Andrews. I don't know what he does. St. Paul, you know, one of the saints. And we pray, please help me through this turmoil. I will make amends. I will change myself. Just help me through this thing. Something like that. And then we find also, and we sometimes add this on, I of myself can do nothing. I of myself can do nothing. The Father worketh hitherto, and I work. Well, prayer has some good points. You know, we sit for meditation here, and it sort of takes the place of prayer, except you get into a dilemma, and all of a sudden this wells up in you. And yet, look at yourself when this wells up. When you pray, or if you're pleading for something, plead honestly. Plead without deception. See? And if you can do this, you will see something about yourself. You might even see how you deceive yourself. You know, once upon a time, I was 18. And I had gotten myself into a kind of a mess. And so I prayed. And in my prayer, you know, I, you know, just please, whoever's out there, listen, get me out of this mess. You know, I promise this and I promise that and I promise I'll never do this thing again. Just get me out of this. And as soon as I thought that, it really brought me up short. Really. I knew I was lying. And what's the point of praying with a lie? By my very nature, I would do that thing again. So, what's the good of asking God to help me if, you know, it's my nature, I'm going to do this thing. So I went out and helped myself. And it turned out all right. You know, after all, things work out, usually, if you make an effort or if you don't make an effort, because everything is changing. So things work out. The only thing you really have to make an effort for, of course, is to earn a living so you can stick around. And you got to stick around because you got to make an effort for this thing in, that you're holding in here, in your mind, this focus, this meditation. Prayer has the significance. You just remember, it doesn't change God or change the one you're praying to, even St. Jude. Doesn't even change him one iota. No. God is immutable. He doesn't change at all, so you can't change him. But what is significant about it is that it changes you. When one has this prayer, you're just not repeating words. You're in trouble and you need help and this rises in you and you plead, you know. When you're doing that, you become humble. There's a humility about it. And you are at that moment ready to surrender. In this particular instance, all of a sudden you accept your not knowing. You accept this agnosia, see? And in this you have the capacity to bow down and you lose a little bit of your egoistic arrogance and stiffness, see? Prayer in this manner, with no words, it's just this feeling, it is this letting go. And in that let go, in that rising, you just automatically move in the right direction. You have not demanded anything. It has been no demand on your part. You cannot demand and let go. No. And you don't talk about it, your problem. It's just this... There's no, you don't need any words for that. I of myself can do nothing. This, you know, you don't talk about it. And there's no need to shout about it. You know, it's like this great Indian mystic, Kabir, he was walking down the street early one morning and he passed a mosque. And the priest was up there shouting his morning prayers, shouting loud. Everybody on the block could hear him. You know, so Kabir went in and he shook him. And he asked him, what are you doing? Do you think your God is deaf? Why do you shout? Just the whisper is going to do it. In fact, there's no need even to whisper. An attitude is enough. That's the thing. Maybe that's what I mean by prayer, is this attitude which turns me in the right direction. This attitude of, I don't know, this agnosia, and I don't know, and it just, you know, what are you going to say about it? You can't say anything, really, but it moves you in the right way. And then he says, direct us to the heights of mystical revelation, sublime beyond all thought and light. Now, we have been told often enough that the thinking mind cannot go beyond the known. It may wonder, and it may question, and it chews things around and spits them out again, and finds that it really didn't have an answer. It's only got more questions.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.